Well, it's my pleasure this morning to welcome to you Dr. J.J. Jackson. She is Vice President for Institutional Diversity at the University of Kentucky and reports both to the President and the Provost, advising them on all academic, fiscal, and administrative policy decisions regarding the university's diversity goals. That includes developing and implementing and evaluating the university's diversity plan and an active community involvement around diversity issues. She is the senior administrative officer responsible for promoting collaboration among faculty, staff, administration, and students in earnest pursuit of UK's diversity goals. Dr. Jackson, though, comes to UK with a rich background. She was Dean of Students at Vassar College, Associate Vice President for Student Affairs at New York University, Executive Assistant to the President and Clerk of the Corporation at Babson College in Massachusetts. She held several positions at MIT, including Associate Dean for Undergraduate Education and Student Affairs and Director of Minority Education. She was an ombudsman in the President's Office and Special Advisor to the Provost on Faculty Diversity. She's been Assistant Dean for Advising, Counseling, and Minority Programs at Cornell University's College of Engineering and Advisor to Minority and Foreign Students at Bucknell University. She also taught freshman writing at Susquehanna University. Dr. Jackson earned her doctorate at Harvard University Graduate School of Education, her master's at Bucknell University, and her bachelor's degree at the University of North Carolina in Greensboro, which is her home. Shortly after Dr. Jackson, though, came to Lexington, just a year and a half ago, it was. Esther and I met with her to welcome her to the community and to introduce her to Asbury College. At that meeting, I had the privilege of getting to know an amazing, brilliant leader who accepted God's call to come to a major university in Kentucky to lead them to becoming a welcoming, caring, and inclusive community for all God's children. The time Esther and I spent with Dr. Jackson flew by as we sat mesmerized by her stories and insights, as I'm sure you will soon experience for yourselves. She is a woman who walks the talk and sees no obstacle that she isn't willing to tackle to fulfill her calling. Please welcome me. Well, join me in welcoming Dr. Jackson to share her heart and vision for a better world.
Thank you very much for that warm welcome. Good morning. It's really nice to be here. This is my, I think, second visit to your campus, and it felt like a well-kept little secret. It's like, wow, this place is like hidden over here. How many people come here? This is a nice little place. And it must be really nice to be able to come together the entire campus like this a couple of times a week in open and wanton abandon celebration of your relationship with God. You know, in other schools, and I've worked at a number of schools, it's not always this kind of freedom that we see. In fact, the last place that I worked, a lot of the students who had deep religious beliefs felt silenced in many ways and felt that they couldn't celebrate what they believed and felt they couldn't share it with others across the campus. So I think in many ways you are fortunate, but also in many ways you carry a burden. And that burden includes how do you spread that farther and deeper to other people? How do you help others to free up their sense of expression to openly and strongly share what they believe without fearing that they're going to lose some opportunity because they shared their beliefs? Do you run into anything like that on this campus? Yes, no? No? Do you run into anything like that when you leave the campus? Yes? Okay, they told me that you were a responsive group. I'm not seeing this. I'm not seeing the love, as somebody wrote to me. So I wanted to provoke your thinking this morning on some very simple ideas. If you were expecting profundity and complexity, I'm going to disappoint you, because I think that God is most often in the simple places and the easy places that we too often overlook, thus losing our opportunity sometimes to share and to spread his love and effect and to help others be still and know his effect in their lives. Because sometimes it's so quiet, we almost miss it. When I was trying to make the decision as to whether or not to accept the position, the offer to come to the University of Kentucky, my prayer was that I wanted to be useful to God in his service and that I would go wherever he sent me because I knew that he would be with me. And then I add, but you got to hit me with a 2x4 because I am really dumb. And I'm afraid I might miss the signs because I don't trust myself. You know, sometimes just because we're close to God, we think that we know what his plan is in our lives. How many of you have heard of the singer Paul Simon? Don't make me date myself here. Okay, good. Do you remember his song, Slip Sliding Away? No? Vaguely? It's okay if it's just vaguely. Well, there's one verse in that song that goes, and God only knows, and God has his plans. The information is unavailable to the mortal man. We work on our jobs, collect our pay, believe we're gliding down the highway when in fact we're slip sliding away. And so we sometimes might miss the cues because we think that we have the right interpretation, when sometimes if we would just be still and listen, we might find a different direction than we thought that God is taking us in, and then we have to be willing to go. And so I decided wherever it is, I'm going, because I know you'll be there, and I want to be useful to you in your service, and I want my life to glorify and to magnify your name. So here I am in Kentucky, learning a lot about its people, just as you are. And so I often ask myself in encounters with different people, I was going to say you're going to find out how technically challenged I was, but somebody has already helped me out. But I often ask myself, what was I thinking? And sometimes you can ask yourself that in different ways. You go, what was I thinking? When something happens, and later when you reflect on it, you are pleased or displeased or even puzzled by your reaction to a given situation. So some of the simple truths that I wanted to talk with you about today have to do with your everyday life. Okay, now you're going to find out if I'm challenged. And the Bible passage that I wanted to use to help guide us in this discussion, and actually it's not a discussion, right? I'm standing up here talking and you're sitting down there listening and you don't get a chance to say anything. So that's not quite a discussion. But let's pretend. Be sincere in your love for others. And the focus we want to come back to there later is sincerity. Hate everything that is evil and hold tight to everything that is good. Love each other as brothers and sisters and honor others more than you do yourself. Honor being the operative word in that sentence. Never give up. Eagerly follow the Holy Spirit and serve the Lord. Let your hope make you glad. Be patient in time of trouble and never stop praying. Take care of God's needy people and welcome strangers into your home. That last verse really hit home to me when 2 days ago I was working at home and unexpectedly the doorbell rang. And because I wasn't expecting anybody, sometimes just like, whoa, what is that? So I go to the door and there stands this young woman who's doing some kind of promotional for Domino Pizza or something. And I had to ask myself after she walked away and I didn't buy any pizza, what was I thinking? Because I live in a neighborhood that is ethnically diverse. It's a small neighborhood, but we rarely see anyone sort of canvassing the neighborhood selling stuff. And the thing that occurred to me was, is this young woman really selling stuff, or is this going to be the beginning of trouble in the neighborhood? You know, is somebody canvassing the neighborhood? Because one of my colleagues talked about a man ringing their doorbell and asking, do you have any rooms for rent, or is your household full? And I thought, what an odd thing to do, to ring the doorbell and ask somebody that question. So when the young woman walked away, I thought, what was I thinking? Why would it occur to me that perhaps this person really isn't peddling pizza, but is canvassing the neighborhood to see what harm might be done later on? What brings us to ask ourselves those kinds of questions in our neighborhoods? And I know that's a rhetorical question, because there is evil in the world. We know this. There are people in the world who don't have good intentions for well-intended people of the world. And so as I ask myself, what was I thinking? What was I thinking? And when you move from that question to what could I be doing differently that could ameliorate this situation so that I don't automatically have to feel suspicious of a stranger in the neighborhood. And I'm sure you've heard that saying that sometimes when you turn a stranger away, you never know when you've turned an angel away or when you've turned away Christ himself and you've missed your opportunity to now help someone. So I often ask myself, what was I thinking? What was I thinking? You have to ask yourself that every day as well. And right here at Asbury College, in this everyday context of yours, despite the fact that there is an open and an unabashed focus on your relationship with God, there are times when I'm sure you have to ask yourself, what was I thinking when I had to face a particular situation? Because among you, as you are moving through this place, some of you, I feel, no doubt, that you face crises of identity sometimes because you have to deal with situations that you don't always understand. Where do you turn when you face a situation that you don't understand? When someone does something and you feel affronted, but you don't know what to do about that. You don't even know whether you should feel affronted, but you're wrestling, grappling with those mixed feelings that are going on inside of you. Beverly Tatum, Bobby Harrow, other researchers describe that as identity formation. And as we go through our lives continuously, me at my age, Esther, Deb, all of your faculty members, your administrators, as well as you, we are all going through identity formation and constantly asking ourselves who we are and what we stand for and what is our calling and, based on our beliefs, what is our responsibility. You have to deal with racial things. When I first came here, and one of the reasons that I did, when I looked at the enrollment at the University of Kentucky and saw that 80% of the undergraduate enrollment is from the state of Kentucky, and that in the state of Kentucky there is less than 7.2% African Americans, and then the other people of color are way behind in their percent representation in that, I thought to myself, I think this is why I'm being sent here, because I seek opportunities to be useful. And in a place with a demographic like that, there must be all kinds of opportunities to help people to grow into embracing our differences and seeing how useless a lot of those differences are and how useful all of our similarities are, despite what we see. So when I look out over the audience and see different faces, I don't see the geography that is represented here, but I can see the ethnic difference that is represented here. I don't see the religious difference that's represented here, but I can see other kinds of differences. And having lived as long as I have lived and worked in as many places as I have worked, I can only imagine the other differences that you're grappling with, and know that you go through day in and day out here in this beautiful place ensconced in this beautiful bucolic setting, grappling with identity. And your peers are also grappling with identity. And believe it or not, whether you know it or not, you're helping them to grapple with their identity as you grapple with your own. Sexual identity. Lots of people are grappling with sexual identity, which doesn't necessarily mean that people are trying to decide, am I gay or not gay, or am I this or am I not that? But how do you feel about those things? I recall my son, who was in the Marine Corps Reserves for several years, and before he joined the Reserves and during the time he was in the Reserves, I was disturbed by the fact that he seemed so homophobic that I was sure that he would hurt a gay person if he knew a gay person from some of the comments that he would make. And then he started college, and he came home one day from a class, a poetry class that he was taking, and he sat down and he said, "Mom, have a look at this." And he shared a poem with me about love. Now, your parents will probably agree with me when they say they don't know everything that you go through when you're in college, because some of your transformations are so personal and private and individual that parents don't always have a right to know those, because you are living your life and figuring those things out for yourself. But I know that somewhere, somehow, something happened that transformed my son's hatred for homosexuals to just accepting people as people. And I was glad for that moment when he shared that poem about love. It was a poem written by a young man who discovered that his brother was gay and how the family was dealing with that. And so when I ask myself, what was I thinking when I think about sexual identity? It is not for me to decide that I should hate somebody because their sexual identity isn't what I think it should be. Because God asked us to love our brothers and sisters and to honor others more than we honor ourselves. That means we can't put conditions on that. We can't say, well, I'll love and honor you if you're straight like me. I'll love and honor you if you're white like me, or if you're black like me, or if you speak Spanish the way that I do, or if you come from the place that I come from. Those are not the conditions that we put on when we try to do God's will and when we try to be still to try to discern how he can use us among his people. And so there are different ways that we have to grapple with relating to others in our environment. And as I think about that and how it comes to be that we grapple, one of the researchers whose work that I rely on a lot is a woman named Bobby Harrow at Springfield College. And I know you can't see that, so I'll just explain to you what this wheel is in front of you. And it's called the cycle of socialization. Let's see, I think this is a little pointer. Maybe not. Okay. All right. Well, in the center is a core where we experience fear, ignorance, confusion, insecurity, all of those emotions that serve to compose the grappling that we do with our identity as we continue through our lives on college campuses, associating with peers, trying to understand where somebody's coming from, trying to be loving, trying to be honorable, trying to honor. Harrow talks about being born into a world with mechanics already in place. So you're born, if you look at that first, that circle on the left, upper left over there, she talks about not choosing what family are you born into? You're simply born into this family, and there's no blame, no consciousness, no guilt, no choice. There is limited information, and sometimes no information. After all, what does a baby want? A baby wants a full stomach, a clean diaper, and somebody to hug him, right? And so that's what you're born into. And as long as somebody's hugging you and you feel that warm bosom, your tummy's full, your diaper's clean, what happens there is the development of trust. And so you grow to trust that small circle of people who are giving you those very basic things that you need. And as you continue to grow, you actually embrace the values of those people whom you trust. Your mom, your dad, the rest of the family, your church, your civic organizations, folks in the community, your dentist, your pediatrician, and all those folks forming your community form also your value set. And as you continue to become socialized, if you follow that arrow that's sweeping over the top of this cycle, you're being taught on a very personal level by your parents, your relatives, your teachers, shapers of expectations. By this time, you're in school and you're reading a lot of stuff that other people have written, all of which is fitting into your value set. And it's being reinforced by messages from other institutions. So as you continue around that and come to the second circle over there, you're being reinforced what you believe by what you see on television and other institutions in which you engage. Now, if you follow and come down to the bottom circle, let's say that's the point where you come to Asbury and you start to get to know folks in other organizations who come from other parts of the community, maybe some from your community, maybe others not, from other parts of the world. And now, for the first time, there are serious challenges to what you believe. This is what college students across the country are experiencing. So what do you do when you experience that dissonance for the first time? The anger. Some people feel dehumanized. There is guilt. There is ignorance. Because when I think, and I don't mean this in a derogatory way, but when I think about a place where most of the students come from a single state, and many of them have not engaged with people from other states, there is de facto an ignorance there about others. And an ignorance about others can breed rejection and challenge your belief in what God can do in your life. And when you are in college and your beliefs and your value sets are challenged, now what do you do? What was I thinking? What did I do with that? Well, when you experience that dissonance, you have to make a choice. You're either going to do something or you're not. And if you're going to make your immediate environment a better place, then there is some action that you have to take. Because even when you leave your immediate environment, the decisions that you made and the actions that you took in your environment will guide you in what you do in your next venue. You are one of more than 1,300 people here at Asbury, and even though you come together like this a couple of times a week, can you say that you're all thinking alike? Do you believe that you're all thinking alike? You can't be all thinking alike. 1,300 people can't be thinking alike. So what do you do with those differences? And your differences are demonstrated in different ways. How are you negotiating those differences? When I contemplated this question some years ago, the first time I created a kind of analogy that I'd like to share with you, I was at MIT. How many of you have ever been to MIT? Great. On MIT's campus, there's a section of a huge dormitory. You've heard of special interest houses, right? And there's this huge dorm that focuses on black culture, where students can choose to live, and it's a male dorm. and they affectionately have referred to it for decades as Chocolate City. Even though it's not just black men who live there, there are some Asian men, Hispanic, a few white men. You just have to have an interest in black culture. And I was new at MIT at the time, and my office was being reviewed by a visiting committee that was one of the members of this committee was a former president of MIT, and I didn't know that at the time. And even though it wouldn't have made a difference if I had known, because I'm one of those crazy people that just kind of, you know, puts it out there and then later go, what was I thinking? After I made my presentation and asked for questions, this man raised his hand and he says, JJ, it was a great presentation. I just have one question. And I said, what's that? And he said, what do you think we ought to do about this separatism on campus? And I said, I'm not sure I understand what you mean. He said, well, Chocolate City. I said, oh, I don't consider that separatism. And there was this audible gasp in the room, like someone had done a chorus and everybody went, oh. And I thought, wow, what did I just say? And his brow sort of furrowed, and I could tell he was wrestling with, how can you not see that as separatism? And I said, well, I look at it this way. If I think about MIT, as you can think about Asbury College, as a hand, and all the students represent the fingers of the hand. Let's say the thumb represents all the black students, and the pointer represents the white students, the Asians, the Hispanics, the Native Americans. I said, there are some days I'm just all thumbs. Do I have to tell you to laugh at that? There are some days I need to be with other thumbs to reaffirm my thumbness. You know, I'm just a thumb. I just want to be with a few other thumbs today. But when you say, give me your hand, I'm right there. Without the thumb, that hand is not going to function very well. In fact, without any one of those digits, the power of that hand is greatly diminished. And so I said to him, there are times when thumbs need to be with thumbs because there are experiences that thumbs have that only thumbs can understand. For instance, you may or may not be aware across the country traditionally predominantly white institutions stepped up their efforts to try to increase the ethnic diversity on campus and affirmative action went into place, often students of color were faced with the quote-unquote challenge that they were only here to fulfill a quota. They didn't deserve to be here. Or they were here because they're a student of color. And then when we started focusing on gender, some would say, well, you only got the job or you only were admitted because you're a woman or you were only admitted because you were black. Well, if I were black, I would have gotten into the school I wanted to go to, too. And then you have to step back and ask yourself, what was I thinking? I remember my own kids having that experience. My daughter was finishing high school and she was riding with some seniors one day, doing whatever they were doing after school, and they were just sharing information about, so where did you accept? Where are you going off to college? Where are you going? Where are you going? And she said, well, I've decided Princeton. And she was admitted in a lot of great schools, Georgia Tech, MIT, Yale, Cornell, Princeton. And she decided on Princeton. And one of her white classmates said, you got into Princeton? I didn't get into Princeton. And she said, really? You didn't get in? I wonder why, because she thought, wow, I think he's as smart as I am. And she says, well, why didn't you get in? And he said, well, look in the mirror. And I sometimes wonder, did he ask himself, what was I thinking? This young woman of mine, and if you ever meet her, you will be amazed. She's just terrific. 750 math achievement. Honor roll, 1,400 board scores back in the day when 1,400 was, you know, off the charts, that someone should say, look in the mirror. That's how you got into Princeton. And then you have to ask yourself, when I look around the room or when I encounter one of my classmates, what am I thinking? do I automatically assume anything that I don't even know whether or not it's true? So when I reflect on that discussion I had with that former president of MIT, and I say there are some days, you know, when you need to reaffirm who you are by being with people like you, but if you confine your existence and your engagement and your interaction only to others like you, therein lies the problem, and there is where the thinking stops. And so that's why I say, when you say, give me your hand, you've got all of those digits there lending to the power and effectiveness of that hand. And without any one of them, it's diminished. So I say, let every group be whoever they are. You know, you don't say to someone, don't associate with your family anymore. We're trying to be diverse here. Of course you're going to associate with your family. So you think of your group like your family. But when the community comes together, when the institution comes together, we are all here together doing the things that we do, allowing each other to be who we are and making every effort to try to understand who we are. So then we ask ourselves, then, what difference do the differences make? The differences define my strengths and what I will bring to the total strength of my institution or my community or my organization, even to my family. And so that transforms the difference into one of the greatest assets that the organization can have, that the family can have, that the institution can have. And what the original scripture is asking us to do is to seek that, search it out, look for it, understand it, love it, use it to multiply the good in the world. That's what is happening there. And when we talk about being still, for that to happen, when you encounter a different situation, you might ask yourself, well, if you think about that hand analogy, which finger are you? What is your job? How do you function with the other fingers? Because as a thumb, when I come to an institution, as in the early days of efforts at greater diversity, I used to consult with a lot of institutions, and they wanted strategies for increasing diversity. And so the first question I would ask is, what do you mean by diversity? And they thought that it was understood, and it's not. And not only did I ask, what do you mean by diversity? Once you understand what you're really saying, do you really want it? Why do you want it? And there again, institutions were puzzled because they thought it would stand to reason why they would want diversity. Well, it doesn't. You should be able to say why you want anything. An institution should be able to say why it wants diversity. Why? What's the vision of the institution for itself? And that's not an embarrassing question. That's a question that is integral to where the institution sees itself going. Why does it want diversity? Because once you say that, then you no longer bring students unlike the majority of students and then expect the other students to change, to adapt. Now you have to look like, act like, talk like, think like those of us who are already here, because that's not diversity, that's assimilation. And I don't know many people who want to assimilate. Most people want to retain their own identity. So when you want diversity, you're inviting different people, whether that's a geographic difference, an ethnic difference, a religious difference, a sexual orientation difference, whatever that difference is, you're asking them to bring the best of their thinking and their beliefs to the collective and add to the way the institution goes about sorting out issues and solving problems. Because if everybody thought the same way, then we're getting nowhere fast. So which finger are you? What were you thinking? And knowing the importance of the power of that hand should reinforce your thought about who you are, and your job in helping Asbury College to become the institution it is becoming. No institution has arrived yet. None of us are there yet. We're all still striving to be someplace different than we are, which we hope is a better place. And we rely on you to help make that happen. And in order for you to help make that happen, then you have to decide, well, then who am I? And what is my contribution to this process? Which finger am I? Can I be still and feel which way God is trying to use me in this process? The health and the strength and the future of Asbury College relies on your going through that process for you to continually ask yourself, what was I thinking? What was I thinking? I wish you many times asking yourself that question. I wish you strength in dealing with the differences that you observe and perceive. I wish you confidence in finding out and knowing who you are. I wish you courage in using that knowledge to help make this a better place so that Asbury College can help to make the world a better place, because we rely on you for doing that. We can't get there without your going through that process. That is my prayer for you. And as I close, I would like to sing the last stanza of Lift Every Voice again. That verse means a lot to me because it expresses all the trials and challenges of what I just finished talking about, deciding, well, which finger am I? And what is my job in working with the rest of the fingers to make this hand strong so that this hand moves about the community, helping to make it a better place? May God bless all your relationships, and may God bless the rest of your life and everything that you do to make this world a better place. Thank you.